actually did sort of from day to day, and what actually made you sort of young lads who are 20, 19, who are unemployed, go out and take on the authorities. It must take a lot of doing.
Well, it was not everybody who was on the trespass was unemployed. Probably, I should imagine, probably half or a third of them would be unemployed, but quite a number of them were working. The whole feature was that the majority of the lads were living in towns, but even that doesn't apply to everybody. I'll come back to that in a minute. They were living in towns where the conditions were really rotten, and the opportunity of getting out weekends was pretty well taken up by most young people, especially the ones in towns. They would go out cycling, they go out rambling, and if there was any interference with their privilege or what have you of going out, then of course they were very resentful.
Yeah.
God, kept particularly camping.
Was there not much to do in the towns at all? Did other people sort of, did they go down the pub or go to football or
that? Football was very popular, naturally. I should imagine, though I wasn't in that circle, I should imagine that a big number of them would go drinking.
Yeah.
They must have done. I just can't pretend to know because,
yeah,
as I say, I wasn't involved in that kind of thing,
yeah,
personally. My friends and the people I associated with were very, very keen on going out of doors all the time at every opportunity, away from the town conditions. There was a fair amount of gambling, I think, too, at the time. Lots of them would be hanging around street corners because street corner betting was the thing. A number of them would be playing various gambling games in the streets with people watching out for the police. That was, not say popular, but that was in vogue. But the groups I knocked around with were mainly involved in in going out for weekends.
Well, apart from the bad conditions and everything, what was the special attraction of sort of going out onto the moors?
It's very hard to answer, isn't it?
Yeah.
It was a sense of freedom. You were out there, the wind was blowing, the rain was lashing onto you. It was such a change from what you were normally accustomed to, that it was a great pleasure. You went out to get out in the open. Pardon?
You went to get sun or shine.
Oh, good God, yes. Yeah. In general, yes. We went out in winter in the snow and ice, and there was no special footwear available or anything like that. What we used to wear were working boots or ex-army boots, nailed with nails, and those very few people who were the elite among us, and I wasn't in that category, would go in for all the various fancy nails, alpine nails, Ciccone nails, Swiss nails, and they'd nail the boots up accordingly, but they weren't all that numerous. It was a little bit fashionable to do that among someone.
When did you start the walking?
I think I started walking from the age of about 15 or 16. I first started cycling. That was my first great key to going out of doors. And once I started cycling and got into places like the Lake District and North Wales, I only had an ordinary roadster bike, a homemade tent. But once I got out and realised how attractive it was on the moors, then of course I would leave the bike behind and walk.
Yeah, were you part of a club?
Was
it just a group of friends in there?
For many years I just went out on my own, mixing with people on the route, of course, but I wasn't in any club or anything. Then later on, two or three of us at the garage where I worked started to go out camping weekends, and we weren't a club or anything like that, but we went out as a group for quite a period, and gradually that's how we adopted the club atmosphere. Then I can't remember precisely when I actually did join a cycling club, and the club I joined was the Clarion Cycling Club. It must have been about 1930.
Were there any sort of political leanings to these clubs, or was it?
No, not all of them. The group of lads I went out with originally from work were just not interested in politics at all. Not especially, you know, they'd talk like anybody else would talk, but they weren't particularly politically inclined. I think as much as anything, it was just the fun of going out weekends and going out in the open air that attracted them. When I joined the Clarion Cycling Club, it was obviously a socialist cycling club, but more or less it was a side issue by the time I joined. It might have been very, very political at one time, but by the time I joined it...
Just turned into...
It was a cycling club, and there were discussions occasionally. In the clubhouses that we owned, they had one in Ribchester, another one in Hanforth, which later on moved to the Bolin Valley. There were debates and things like that on Sunday nights occasionally.
Occasionally, yeah. So it was more just a recreational sort
of... It was recreational, but of course people, obviously, like in any other walk of life, would be discussing politics.
Yeah.
Problems of various kinds.
But primarily it's just to get away from...
Absolutely, yes. And in the cycling club, of course, it was quite a competition atmosphere, because there was road racing, and a little bit of track racing, so it was, in that respect, it wasn't just a matter of going out, but also racing and sport. But essentially, I think it was a matter of getting out, and we got one or two very experienced cycle leaders who knew Cheshire and Derbyshire like the back of the hands, and all the back lanes. It was really first rate. So later on, my chief pleasure was to walk and not so much to cycle.
Where did you go from in the Peak District? Did you go to Hayfield?
Pretty nearly from Hayfield regularly. Sometimes from Glossop, sometimes from Chapel, but generally from Hayfield. Yeah. Hayfield seemed to be the mecca.
Did most people used to go out there on the train?
Well, most people, I think, would go on the train, but I only went on my bike.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever been on that train. I can't remember anyhow.
Yeah.
Great pity, because it's no longer there, but I don't think I ever went on that train.
So how did it all build up into this?
We started regular weekend camps with groups, and we formed a sports group for camping and rambling, and I think you say you've read the book, you know the incident when we went from Rowarth. We were trying to take a group on to Bleaklow, and we got turned back, and it really niggled us. Of course, the aggravation of being turned back was there all the time. It was a constant thing you had to put up with when you were rambling. If you weren't actually turned back, the threat of being turned back was always there. Oh, and I was coming to mention another point. When I said it was mainly the young people who wanted to get away from the rotten conditions in towns who were on that do, it wasn't them alone, because I'm very mindful of one of our supporters who I'm now very friendly with, who came from Mellor, and I'm not sure if at the time he didn't live in New Mills, but obviously he was a stone's throw away from Derbyshire. Well, he was in Derbyshire, but a stone's throw away from the moors. Yeah. But he used to go out quite regularly. He was a very, very keen rambler.
Yeah.
And he wasn't unique in that respect. quite a number of the boys and girls from Glossop and Mellor, and certainly from Stockport, though of course Stockport was a town, were very, very keen on the moors.
So there's a lot of a bit of difference over on the actual trespass on in varying accounts, whether this big fixation with actually getting to the top and whether you did or whether you didn't.
Well, that's,
it's either neither here nor
there. That's
really.
It's neither here nor there. I've never really understood the motives. I can quite understand that the motives of that keeper, I forget his name now, who went very, very sneeringly in the evening news. He said they never even got to the top. He watched them and he was at the downfall and he saw his... Well, of course, only a lunatic could go up the downfall with a whole crowd of people. We weren't that daft, and we knew, of course, because, as I tell you in the book, I'd gone out with my mate Wolfie Winnick in the morning, and we'd had a little bit of a reconnoitre of the area, and we knew pretty well that at the downfall there was quite a group of keepers. We could see them, and we weren't blessed with binoculars like they were, but we could see them knocking around, so we didn't intend to go there. Now, as far as whether we went up Ashup Head and on to Kinder, or whether we took the straight climb up off the side of William Clough, I'm pretty sure in my mind that we went up the hard way. We went up from William Clough, just beyond a little group of falls there, and we scrambled up there. And in fact, in quite a number of the newspapers reporting, with one exception, that was the Manchester Guardian at the time, with one exception, they all explain how we went up that very, very steep slope. In fact, in the evidence in court, they say that we went up Sandy Hayes. Well, it was a little bit beyond there.
Yeah.
It was up the steep side.
So, do you think you're fairly treated by the press? Or?
Oh, no, the press...
they're on the
side. I'm pretty sure that, in the first place, a lot of the press never went all the way. They didn't know precisely what had happened. They wrote their accounts afterwards in the pubs. That's my feeling, I'm not sure, of course. As far as the chap who wrote the article for The Guardian is concerned, I don't know who he was, but he was very, very bigoted when he said all the church bells were pealing an out of triumph. Well, the church bells were probably ringing at the time that they always ring in late afternoon when we got back. And you could see sneers and hostility to the whole thing in quite a lot of the accounts.
How about the local people? What did they think of it? Or were they that bothered?
Well, they were obviously worried because there'd been a bit of a build-up in the press, and they just didn't know what to expect. And if you can use a comparison, last year we had the 50th anniversary, and one or two of the local councillors, I'll not mention them, you probably know who I mean, shot the mouths off at a council meeting and then to the local press to such an extent that a lot of people thought that our 50th anniversary was going to culminate in riots and fights with the police and God knows what. And even this year, on the 24th of April, somebody had hinted to the police and to the press that there was going to be a monster repetition of the trespass onto Kinder, because it wouldn't be trespassing now. And the chief warden, just forget his name, from Hayfield, rang me to ask me how many to expect. Oh, I said, there'll be about a dozen of us, one or two of the old-timers, and one or two kids are coming along, 12 or 14. He said, well, the newspapers are suggesting going to be a big number. And I said, you ought to know by now not to believe the newspapers. And when we got to the quarry, we found that there were more police there than there were ramblers. We had about 14 or 15. As I said, it was a low key, just so affair between a few people.
It seems to, the actual trespass itself seems to have lasted a long time, the memory of it.
Do you think it's been blown up? Most definitely, pardon?
Do you think it's been blown up out of proportion a lot?
Well, there's a...
the effect?
No. The thing about the trespass was that we proved by going in numbers, you could no number of, they couldn't get enough keepers to stop you. We proved that if you got support from the ramblers, you could go onto the moorland. We proved that, and of course, it also highlighted the fact that the police were not able legally, and they were certainly unwilling, as much as they might be under the patronage of some of the big landowners. They were unwilling to take direct action on the moors.
Yeah.
They're unwilling to do that. So if you we prove the point that if enough turned up, you could go onto the moors, irrespective of the number of keepers they could turn out, because they had a lot of keepers for the weekend, as you know. Lots of keepers were, special keepers were roped in, and this fella Beavers was a special keeper, so-called, this chap who was injured. And that being the case, and the indignation after we were sentenced, and the number of police who were involved, there was a third of the Derbyshire police force there at Hayfield, just sheer lunacy. It so highlighted the business that it couldn't be ignored.
Do you think there was a lot of worry, though, on the side of the authorities over sort of mass actions like that at the time?
Well, it wasn't like today. Today, there's mass action over everything, mass action over the nuclear bombs, mass action over unemployment. It wasn't like that. There were unemployed marches, perhaps one or two a year, because there was a lot of unemployment at the time, but there wasn't mass action in that respect.
No.
So, I've no doubt that the idea of mass action in the countryside would have frightened them.
Yeah.
Could have done, yes. But the residents of Hayfield, while they didn't know just what to expect, I don't think they were fearful of life and limb, because one of the things about unlawful assembly, one of the constituents, and that's what we were originally charged with, was that it was an assembly of people that would cause one or more people to be afraid of damage to their to them or to the property. And I always challenged them in court, who were these people and would they produce them, so that we could ask them just what they were afraid of, and they never did it. And it's only at the Assize Court trial in Derby, when one of the police witnesses said, well, it was obvious, you know, when I asked the same question, who the people were, it was obviously the landowners who were afraid of the consequences of the mass trespass. So that was... That was... Well, what the people were afraid.
How do you feel about, at the time, and how do you feel now, about the rights of landowners, as opposed to, were you just after access to the land, or do you believe that the land should, you know,
well, at the moment, let's put it this way, if we can achieve access to all uncultivated land without, you know, and accepting the fact that we don't expect, nor would we countenance any damage to anybody's property, or the buildings or the walls or anything like that, I firmly believe that we should have that kind of access. Now, whether it should all belong to the people and that is a matter that, at this stage, I'm not very concerned with. I know it's just some kind of a pipe dream, and it for and at this stage of the game, it wouldn't matter all that much. I would be quite happy if we were to get direct access to all uncultivated land, without hindrance and without having to pay for it, because that's one of the new things that's creeping on the on the horizon, you know.
It's the same with everything.
Yes.
Pay for everything.
That's right. They expect the public to pay for that, and that would be grossly unjust, because if you go back 200 or 300 years, there was no such thing as private moorland and that kind of thing. It was all public, and it was enclosed during the enclosures period. I'll not use the word confiscated, though it could be used. It was just taken off the public and given into private hands, allegedly for the purpose of improving agriculture. So you can hardly call grouse shooting agriculture.
How do you feel about grouse shooting? You think it's...
I'm not bothered. I'm not bothered. There are quite a big number of ramblers who get very hot and bothered under the collar about it. I'm not bothered. If people want to shoot grouse, I think it's a bit unsporting the way it's done. But if they want to do it, and if they want to pay money for it, and if it finds a job of work for a few days for the local youngsters to act as beaters, what have you, and provides a bit of business for the people who make these very, very posh shotguns, well, I couldn't be bothered. But the whole thing stinks of snobbery and privilege. Mm. I've no respect for them, but I don't care a damn if that's the way they want to do it. Okay, for the time being at any rate, I would not bother about it.
Yeah.
What the future holds, of course, nobody knows.
How did you feel at the time? Were you more strongly in your views at the time, in the 30s?
Pretty much the same as now.
As long as you
can. There was one thing where I've changed considerably. In the 30s, there were different groupings, I suppose there are to an extent today, but not to the same extent. Among the ramblers, there were some of the very, very posh upper crust ramblers who really thought they were better than the boys and girls who came out of the towns, and that created quite a lot of hostility, that snobbery, and I felt, well, these people weren't interested in access, they weren't interested in us, they were quite happy with the state of affairs, and for my part I wasn't concerned with them. But I realise now that a lot of those people were as misguided in their attitude towards us, the working class boys and girls, as we were towards them, and I'm quite happy to link up with anybody and everybody who's prepared to go along in their efforts to get access. Mm. I'm not worried about their social origins and that kind of thing, because I know that
all up to the same end.
Well, not all, but a big number are.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's pretty recognised now that we'll have to do it through the House of Commons, and the big thing now is to win public support and public approval.
Yeah.
And like lots of other things, of course, the public isn't particularly interested. Mm-hmm. Only the people who are involved are interested.
Yeah. So.
We've got a long way to go.
A long way to go, because there's only the Peak District, really, isn't there, that's open.
Yes, and we seem to have come to a stop now in the Peak District with getting further access. And that's because before you can come to access agreements with landowners now, you've got to provide them with wardens, rangers, and you've got to pay them sums of money for any possible, possible insurance and damage to their property, or people who might have an accident on their property. So money being less and less available to public bodies like the Peak Park and other national parks, it's becoming quite a problem. And on the Countryside Commission, it seems to be, whereas that it was set up to represent all sections of users of the open air, it's now, the government is now putting and heavily weighing the Countryside Commission with landowners and farmers, and making it very unbalanced and lopsided and biased, of course.
In some ways you can see the point of view of the, with the pressure of the population. station on the Peak District, which is surrounded, you can see the point of view of the farmers and their walls and everything, and fences, but I feel that, you know, people should have access to it, but how do you feel? Do you think the rights of access should go above the farmers' rights?
Well, the farmers are more negligent in maintaining the walls and the fences than anybody, let's be fair. The National Trust has just bought Kinder Scout,
yeah,
and they're having to rebuild probably miles of walls just to contain the sheep, which have virtually torn the Kinder moorland to pieces because it's been overgrazed.
That's another thing, the erosion. Is that, a lot of people blame it on the increased walkers?
Well, they play a part. But the main cause of erosion, I think, can be laid down to the fact of overgrazing.
Yeah, no, it's about 4,000.
But I was just going to say that, so you can see that the previous people who farmed in that area weren't as fussy about maintaining the walls and the fencing as they should do, and it's costing the National Trust a tremendous amount in rebuilding the walls, and they're able to rebuild the walls to an extent with some of these youth opportunity program trainees, and the fencing, it's costing a great deal, and rebuilding the stiles is costing money. So unquestionably, whilst I agree that ramblers must not abuse what's there, we mustn't imagine for one minute that it's the ramblers who've knocked the walls down which are now lying down. It's old age and neglect in the main, and the big stretches of walling, as you know, being a hayfield lad, that are lying down there where ramblers never go. Now, as far as the walking erosion is concerned, it's a big problem and it's not going to be solved overnight. You know that we've now set up the Kinder Advisory Committee, the Kinder Scout Advisory Committee, which is there to help and advise the National Trust in doing its job.
Yeah.
Not like it, but no. They're certainly cooperating with us. And the National Trust is going to try and improve some of the worst stretches of footpaths on the top of Kinder, you know, where you go down way over the top of your boots in peat and in mud. Now, if they do improve that, and certainly we hope it's going to be done in a manner that won't be unsightly. If they do, then I'm sure that people will use the improved paths where you come to boggy stretches, and not keep on walking further and further out and extending the erosion. But the big thing about the overuse of certain footpaths is that the walkers and the ramblers have not yet become accustomed to going over the wild moorland as such, and they still do tend to stick to footpaths. And the Peak Park had a survey, I think it was last year, and they said that 90% of the ramblers still adhere to footpaths, even where they've got access to the moorland itself. Now, that's something which is very natural. I mean, people will go on the most convenient, cross on the most convenient way, but that's how footpaths arose. It wasn't the ramblers that made the footpaths, it was the people who travelled the country, whether they were people who were moving from one part to another, or the pack horse people carrying goods, they all established a footpath originally. But I'm sure that when walkers, and it's not going to be done overnight, it's going to be a slow process, become accustomed to finding their way across open moorland, more and more will do that, and the pressure on the footpaths will ease. But also, of course, when we get more access into parts of, for example, the Peak District, you know that 75% of the Peak District is still inaccessible legally.
Yeah.
Lots of people go over Morelands to which they've no legal right to go, but the owners are now not bothering. They're not they're not keeping it. They're leaving people alone in many parts, especially on the Sheffield side. Now, when more of this becomes accessible, then the pressure on the on Kinder itself and the top will ease considerably.
Yeah.
And also, of course, some of these long-distance footpaths like the Pennine Way, which were very, very good in the day, have now become a kind of magnet for people who are not used to it. And there'll have to be ways of educating people into some of the lovely parts of the country, which is relatively unknown.
Yeah.
And of course, there are parts of the country where they're very, very rigid about access, like the Strath of Bowland, but periodically having brushes with landowners and keepers. And when we do get access on a national scale, then lots of the problems that we're experiencing with overwalking will disappear.
Could you see, like today, another sort of mass action? And do you think it's a good sort of tool to use?
Well,
against
it might be the last resort. I've been on one or two minor mass trespasses on the Sheffield side this year, and what struck me on the last one I was on, I can't remember exactly when it was. It was earlier this year. Was the kind of people who came on it? It was lots of young married couples with kiddies. There were as many young kids on it as there were as adults. It was amazing, and it was a real happy-go-lucky do. And the police cooperated. They opened some of the locked gates for us. that the press never reported it because it wasn't sensational. Nobody got knocked around. There were no brushes with keepers and the police. It was just a happy Sunday event, and it was really nice too. Now, not all the things like that, not all big trespasses are going to go like that.
No.
But if we fail to get public support, and if we fail to get things through the House of Commons by negotiation, then I'm sure that we're going to get mass action again.
Yeah.
That's inevitable. Mm. And they may have walkie-talkies and God knows what today, the keepers and the police, but some of the ramblers. And we're going to see some interesting things happen. But I'm hoping that with public support and public pressure, we can get these things. Because the television regularly points out lovely beauty spots, certainly in our part of the world, and I should imagine they do the same elsewhere. And people are not prepared to stand for some of the injustices that they had to endure years ago, in spite of unemployment and poverty and what have you. People have become a lot broader minded. In fact, in some countries, they can't imagine what trespassing is because it's so ridiculous.
Yeah.
And it takes me back to when my kids were very little. They'd been out rambling, of course, right from being babies. And we were in the Lake District, and we'd been to Grasmere for a few days and walked along wherever we wanted on the tops, and we came down to Windermere, and there was a path, you know, big notice on trespassers will be prosecuted, no road, and I'd got the young kids with me, and there were only the wife and the two kids with me at the time, so I didn't want to have a brush with anybody.
No.
So they were dashing through. I said, no, you can't go that way, love. I said, why? I said, well, it's private. And the little girl said, what is private, Dad? It was so hard to answer because it's so ridiculous. We were just going to walk on it, and we were, it was sacrilege. How dare we?
Yeah.
And I couldn't explain to her what private was. And it must be the same with lots of people from abroad when they hear of our trespass laws.
Well, thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
Most informed.
Just check it, is it playing?
I hope so.
We'll just try it.